Not too long ago, we aired a show done by Alex Smith and his amazing radio show called Radio EcoShock, where he talked about fumes from airports and airplanes and the toxic chemicals that come from those flying around in the sky. Well, we here in Hamilton have our own serious airport toxic issue, and it comes in the form of PFAS, which is a chemical flame retardant that can be found also in your carpet cleaner, your Scotch brand products that you put on your couches.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Apparently it was banned, but not in enough time to stop the serious water damage done to Lake Neapinko and the Welland River up by Bimbrooks Airport here in Hamilton. It's just starting to come out now, but apparently this toxic situation has been going on for over 30 years. We are speaking today to Dr. Joe Miner. He's in our studio today. He's a volunteer with Environment Hamilton, and what we're talking about is toxic chemical runoff from the Hamilton Airport that is going into a watershed and the Welland River.
This is a very large and complicated issue, and my ability to communicate clearly about it is being hampered by the fact that much of the information that needs to be released to the public hasn't been released to the public, has not been released to the public, either by the airport. And in this case, the airport means all of the operators of the airport, both federal, municipal, and the private operator, as well as the Ministry of the Environment. They both know a lot more about this than they are telling the public. So I'm going to tell you what I understand to the best of my ability for the little bits of information that have been released and the little bits of information that Environment Hamilton has collected itself.
When did this start for you?
For me, it started probably around the beginning of the year or late last year, when we were being contacted by fishermen who are fishing at Bimbrook Reservoir and had been hearing rumors that the fish there were contaminated.
How did they know that?
I think that, well, that, and again, I don't know the exact timeline here.
Okay.
And so essentially what happened was, let me just kind of go over kind of what I think is a concise version of history, and it's easier for me but to kind of start at the beginning. Essentially, in Hamilton, when I moved here, you fairly rapidly are told that you shouldn't you should limit your consumption of fish from Hamilton Harbor and Lake Ontario, because it's widely understood that Hamilton, Ontario, to a greater extent, and Lake Ontario to a lesser extent, have contaminated fish in them. And so as a result, a number of people, including me, who like to fish, catch the fish, and eat the fish, try to find places where the fish are less contaminated. And so one of the places that you get out the map and you look at it is this nice little lake known either as Lake Neapinko or the Bimbrook Reservoir, which is to the southeast of Hamilton. And it's out in the countryside, and it looks like it should be a nice, clean lake. And for years and years, people have gone there thinking that that was a clean lake. And that applied not only to people fishing like me, who went there and caught the fish and ate the fish, but also to a scientist who – there was a scientist at the Canada Centre for Inland Waters, an Environment Canada scientist, who – was studying a new class of chemical contaminants in the environment of major concern known as perfluorocarbons, and in particular one known as PFOS, perfluorooctane sulfonate. It was generally thought that the dominant source for these chemicals to the environment of the Great Lakes region was actually from sewage treatment plants just downstream of major population centers. And so he collected turtles from Coots, you know, next to Hamilton Harbor, and the Humber River area in Toronto near a sewage treatment plant there. And he wanted to go to what he thought was a nice, clean control site to collect a uncontaminated turtle. He was studying this chemical in the serum of snapping turtles. And to his surprise, when he got the results back, what he found was that in contrast to expectation, the turtles in Lake Neopinco or Benbrook Reservoir were much more contaminated than what he thought were his contaminated sites. And in fact, it turns out on subsequent analysis, the turtles in that lake are the most contaminated turtles in the world with PFAS.
Didn't I read someplace that some of those balances were three times higher than the world level?
It's three times the world level, I know, is the case for carp. It could actually even be more than that for the turtles.
Now, that's pretty amazing to think about the levels all over the world, that we here in Hamilton have that much pollution, and it's coming from the airport.
Yeah, this is true. The problem with a lot of this data is a lot of it isn't publicly accessible. And so if you look either in the scientific peer-reviewed paper by the scientist that came out, he's a very careful scientist, and so he's not going to say these are the world's most contaminated turtles. What he's going to say is this is the amount that I measured, and it is much higher than all of the other figures that I can find in the literature. If you, in common English, read what he says, that means the same thing. In other words, as far as anybody knows, these are the most contaminated turtles in the world. So I guess that quote would come from me, but it's a direct logical inference from what's in the published paper.
And it can be found. Do you know the actual web address for his paper?
The paper is highly elevated levels of perfluorooctane sulfonate and other perfluorinated acids found in biota and surface water downstream of an international airport, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, published in Environment International, volume 39, pages 19 to 26. Actually, the publication date is 2012.
Thanks, that helps. That'll help people if they want to go and find it.
That's the paper publication date. It was available online given a few months ago. So you can go Google that title, and it will pull you to an abstract. And if you want to read the whole thing, it's kind of like a music download.
Technical, though.
Well, it's not that technical. Well, look, it is. It's highly technical. There's parts of what are called the statistical analysis and the principal components analysis that I don't really totally understand myself.
Can I get you to clarify what that chemical is?
Well, there are actually this paper identifies literally dozens of perfluorocarbons.
Which are?
Perfluorocarbons are the general class of chemicals. And the prefix perfluoro means that, well, the carbon means that it's, quote, what organic chemists call an organic molecule. It's not what the public thinks of as organic. There's a field in science called organic chemistry. The thing is that organic chemistry involves molecules whose backbone is carbon. And perfluoro means that all the hydrogens on the carbon backbone have been substituted with fluorine. And so the general class is perfluorocarbons. What this paper finds is that there are literally, I believe, over a dozen different perfluorocarbons that can be found downstream of the Hamilton International Airport. The dominant one by mass is a perfluorooctane sulfonate, which is believed to be mainly from, in this case, the airport, what's something called a firefighting foam or an aqueous film forming foam. But there is also, interestingly, another perfluorocarbon that is known as PFECHS, which is perfluoroethyl cyclohexane sulfonate.
And basic English means?
The same molecule, but has the carbon chain on the end wrapped around into a circle. This latter chemical is actually found, it is believed, exclusively in aircraft hydraulic fluid. And so taken together, what these results say is that there are at least two sources of perfluorocarbons running into the environment off the Hamilton International Airport. Probably the bulk of them are from firefighting foams, aqueous film-forming foams, and the other ones are from hydraulic fluid, this other one at least. Just real quick, the particularly this latter one, you can detect this particular perfluorocarbon, PFECHS, not just immediately downstream from the airport, but the plume of contamination extends all the way down to the lake and significantly past the lake, I believe about 50 kilometers downstream. It has been detected pretty much as far down as they tested in this
Little Lake.
In the Little Lake and in the stream that runs through it and past it. So at a few sites downstream of the lake, they can detect it as well. At some point, it will become so diluted that it would become difficult to detect, but they really haven't tried to find how far down they can find it. That's not really a pressing science issue.
Okay, a couple of points I would like to clarify for myself. firefighting foam, that is not firemen? Is it regular firemen doing their tests? And I thought that foam was banned in 2001.
Yeah, no, boy, I don't want to get into what the rules were because they are complicated and they're exemptions. And so what I do know is that the last place where there was an exemption to allow for its use was specifically at airports for aircraft firefighting. Mm-hmm. They're essentially, it's a very interesting story in that as this chemical was invented, it was viewed as wonderful, it was viewed as harmless, and we started using it in tons of stuff. And in particular, not only were we using it in places where its chemical properties were deemed necessary, like firefighting foams and aircraft hydraulic fluid, in both cases, to help prevent fires on aircraft, which is, you know, a good thing. But we kind of went hog wild with it, and actually where it became to be used in greater masses, and so this goes back, let's say, like to the early 80s. We began to use it in wider use, and in particular in stain and water-repellent coatings for things like clothing and in particular carpets. And I think people will know that the dominant North American manufacturer in this time period of this was the 3M company, which makes Scotch tape. And so their product that had significant amounts of perfluorocarbon in it was Scotchgard, which you could go to the store and buy aerosol cans of and spray on your clothes and make them shed water. But it turns out that it was also used in stain-resistant carpeting. And so both during the manufacture of stain-resistant carpeting, those manufacturing facilities would have large uses and probably large losses of the material from them. As the reason why, by total mass, actually, as opposed to concentration, a lot of the PFAS is coming from sewage treatment plants. Is as you wash and vacuum your carpets and send the dust in some cases down your drain, particularly if you do like a steam cleaning of your carpets, the you're washing some of this stuff out of your stain resistant carpet and it goes down your drain and out.
So do we end up drinking this at some point?
Yeah, we do. There is low levels because of this widespread use, again, dominant in the 80s. PFAS is now all over the world, and it is in water everywhere at low levels. And it turns out that 98% of the U.S. adult population has detectable levels of PFAS in their blood.
And what does it do to the human body?
Well, that's an interesting and ongoing area of scientific research. And in fact, there was a recent article that came out just really in August 26th, 2011, that I would really recommend people thinking about. It's called Perfluoroalkyl Chemicals and Chronic Kidney Disease in U.S. Adults. And it's in the American Journal of Epidemiology, volume 174, pages 893 to 900, publication date 2011. It reviews the earlier literature from both laboratory experiments, which are causal experiments, where you take PFAS and put it on either human cells in culture or test on lab animals, which indicate a number of problems, most of which involve kidney damage. They actually did a very interesting study using a very large epidemiological database that is commonly in use in the United States that is related to the National Institutes of Health there. And they looked at more than 4,000 people. And you have to be very careful about what you say here because it is very technical and it's still trying to be understood. What you can say is that there's a statistically significant relationship that indicates that PFCs, and in particular PFOA and PFOS, were positively associated with chronic kidney disease. Now, positively associated is important, but more importantly, they were positively associated with chronic kidney disease at the levels that are present in the U.S. population as a whole. Okay, and so this is a big deal. Okay, this isn't like workers in the chemical factories have levels of PFAS that are positively associated with this disease. It is literally everybody. The majority of people in the United States have levels of PFAS in them that are positively associated with chronic kidney disease,
wow,
which is, quoting the scientist, a major public health problem.
Sure. So I imagine okay. Canada is the same. And
There is no reason to suspect the results in Canada would be any different. It would be useful for the Health Canada to conduct a similar investigation in Canada. But until such time as that investigation has taken place, I would think that your best expectation for what's going on in Canada is the results of this paper. Now, this turns out the last couple of days, I've spent a lot of time trying to understand exactly what this positive association means. And it's actually a very interesting and complicated scientific issue. The fact that the association exists and exists at levels that are present in most of the people in the U.S. is unquestionable at a statistical level. There's less than a 99.9% chance that this association, you know, is by chance. The association is real and is really kind of undeniable. What that association means is a very interesting scientific issue. Your first thought is it's causal, right? If people have this level of PFAS and the ones with more of it seem to have worse problems with chronic kidney disease, then your first expectation is that the relationship is causal.
Which means they've used something directly. Oh,
well, it would in this case mean that the higher levels of PFAS are responsible for the higher level of kidney disease. Unfortunately, this is what's called a cross-sectional epidemiological study, which means it is also possible, something called reverse causality is also possible, that these people have something else that causes their kidney disease. And in this case, when their kidneys fail, they are unable to get rid of the PFAS in their bodies. Now, that is also a health concern because the laboratory experiments indicate that PFAS does damage kidneys. And so it could be that you've got something that's causing your kidney disease and as a result you can't get rid of PFAS and then as a result your disease gets worse. But that is actually where further experimentation is needed both in the U.S. and Canada is trying to decide what are the relative odds of this relationship being causal versus reverse causal? Because if it's causal, what it really means is that you really should do your level best to decrease your future exposure to PFAS. As we move forward in time and as we understand how bad this chemical is, in my opinion, we're moving too slow at a regulatory level, but we keep increasing the level of concern over PFAS and increasing the restrictions on its use. There are still exemptions in place for the use of PFAS in aqueous film-forming foams, which are aircraft firefighting foams, that exist in some form until 2013. I think the common sense understanding of those regulations is that you shouldn't be using these materials to practice fire suppression, but it would still be permissible if you had them to use them at extremely low concentrations to actually put out a burning aircraft. But that exemption only lasts for another year or two. And I suspect there is an exemption for the use of PFE-CHS in aircraft hydraulic fluid. I'm not a environmental regulatory expert. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, I think we are now, based on the fact that this levels of this chemical in the environment are in fact a major public health problem, need to be, even if we're going to continue using them, we need to be more careful about not losing them to the environment. And in particular, you know, it's just my expectation that if you have aircraft hydraulic fluid, it really ought to be, you know, either in the airplane or properly disposed of and not flowing for 50 kilometers down the Welland River like it is downstream of the Hamilton Airport.
How long has Hamilton Airport been practicing this way of disposal, do you think?
I don't want to suggest that anything at the airport that has happened is illegal, because it odds are it's not, okay? It basically, what's happened here is, you know, we all thought this chemical was wonderful and we used it everywhere. And now we're finding out that it's a problem and we need to quit spilling it or losing it to the environment, whatever term you want to use. And so really, I think my problem with both the airport and to a lesser extent the Ontario Ministry of the Environment is they are really not being, and actually Transport Canada, is they're not being proactive about this. If you look at the history of this, anyway, they need to be proactive and they need to come out and they say, this is where we have the stuff, this is where we used it, this is where we've lost it to the environment, and these are the things that we're doing to keep it from getting into the environment. And that really isn't happening. And it's frustrating because that we're constantly having to chase and push them. Okay, so for instance, the regulatory agency, which is the Ontario Ministry of the Environment, well, first of all, the airport never reported this problem. It had to be discovered by accident, and the airport as a source had to be pinpointed by a volunteer, actually,
so
me.
Somebody's got to find it and then bring it to their attention.
And so somebody had to find it and bring it to their attention. And to be honest, for the first 2 months, they denied that it was coming from them, even though it was obvious it was. Basically, they're constantly fighting, talking about So the situation was, it wasn't identified by the regulatory agencies. It was identified by accident. It was pinpointed not by the airport or the regulatory agencies. Its source was pinpointed by me. But this kind of refusal to be, you know, open and proactive about what is known about these things is still continuing. So to where, after we pinpointed where it was coming from, the airport now admits that the source of most of the PFAS is from this airport firefighting practice pad. It still isn't telling what it knows about, in particular, the PFE-CHS out of its hydraulic fluid. And so we're constantly having to try to get both the airport and the Ontario Ministry of the Environment to tell what they know. And in particular, we know for a fact that the airport and the Ontario Ministry of the Environment have data on the firefighting practice pad that they have been discussing between the two of them since August, more than 3 months now. And that data, even though we repeatedly asked for it to be released, they aren't releasing to the public. And I just think that this secrecy is both doing a disservice to the public, and it doesn't have a rational explanation, because nobody's suggesting what happened here was illegal. What we are suggesting is that you know, once this problem is identified, you should be more open with the public so that everybody can get used to what's happening and can offer suggestions on, you know, are there places that you aren't thinking about that need remediation? But when the data is being hidden, it's very difficult for the public to know what is known and so what is missing. And that's a real problem. And then the second big problem is when a lot of the data is secret, the magnitude of the problem doesn't get out to the public as quickly as it could. And so as a result, people continue to eat fish contaminated with PFCs and PFAS in particular downstream of the airport.
A couple of questions here for you. First of all, I think we should clarify who owns the airport, who runs the airport, what are the people involved with that location, and
yep.
get into the drinking water. It's got to be in the drinking water at some point.
Again, the details of the legalities of who owns and operates there are better people qualified than me, but since they aren't talking, this is what I think I know. The airport was under federal ownership of the land and operational control up until 1994. In 1994, the ownership of the land and the operation of the airport was transferred to the city of Hamilton. And in 1996, the city of Hamilton retained ownership of the land but leased the operations of the airport to a private corporation. Now, is it in the drinking water? Absolutely. Although, again, it depends on what your source of drinking water is. The fact of the matter is it's in everybody's drinking water at a low level because it's all over the planet at a low level. The question is it in drinking water at elevated levels relative to background? And that depends a lot on where you're getting your drinking water downstream of the airport. If you're getting it from the city's water supply, then whether you live near the airport or not is irrelevant. You're getting the same drinking water that I am from living here near McMaster. If you're somehow on well water or treated well water, you actually are getting elevated levels of PFAS in your water. There isn't really proof that that is causing harm. Just real quick, to kind of visualize the relative levels. If you think of background levels of PFAS as being represented by either the length of a loony, the coin, or the length of a lollipop, that would be the background levels of PFAS in water, say in Lake Ontario. Okay. If you then thought of levels of PFAS in the water of Benbrook Reservoir or Lake Neopinco, those levels are represented by a toddler, you know, just a couple of feet plus or minus, right? If you think of the levels in water at the airport, those are represented by the height of the CN Tower. And so basically there is a huge concentration gradient that occurs as you start at the lake and walk upstream towards the airport. So if you were the living embodiment of the concentration of PFAS in water and you started at Benbrook Reservoir or Lake Neopinco, you would start there as being the height of a toddler. And as you walked upstream, by the time you got to the airport, you would be the height of the CN Tower.
That's a great visualization. So
yeah.
The only way we can find out or compare about consumption is in the wildlife, deer and turtles and fish.
Well, that's the best way. And to be honest, the scientific data that exists to date would say that the toddler levels, which while they are significantly higher than background levels of PFAS, you probably don't accumulate a significant amount of PFAS by drinking water with that level of contamination. you where the dominant route of exposure to people from eating for PFAS into their bodies, it would probably come from eating fish caught in this contaminated waterway.
And so you made up some signs. Now let's get into the political fight that you've had to go through on all levels, just trying to post signs warning people what's going on.
No, that's been a real frustration in that at the outset of this problem being identified, I am concerned that this entire waterway is contaminated to such an extent that the fish shouldn't be eaten. Essentially, the province's official position can be found regarding eating fish can be found in a book that you can find, get on the internet or get mailed to you. It's called The Guide to Eating Ontario Sport Fish 2011-2012 edition. And what that book says is they've tested the fish both from Benbrook Reservoir and from a location kind of halfway upstream between the reservoir and the airport and at a few sites downstream. According to that book, essentially they set what they thought were safe levels of fish to eat. Just some results from that study. One of the things to note is, again, we talked about the turtles being the most contaminated PFAS turtles in the world. It turns out that the carp in this waterway are the most contaminated PFAS carp in the world. And so the carp over a certain length, both in the reservoir and upstream of the reservoir, are contaminated with PFAS at an average level of more than 640 parts per billion. And the previous figure in the literature, the previous world record, was Saginaw Bay in Lake Michigan, where they analyzed about 200 or so carp, and the average was about 50, and the biggest one they found was 197. And so we have carp in this waterway that are averaging more than 640, and the previous highest level was 197.
So it's beyond don't eat the fish. It's the whole food chain.
Even the Ministry of the Environment agrees, based on old science that is in the book, that nobody should be eating the ones that are over 640. The ministry basically says that fish that are contaminated between 80 and 640 can be eaten in lower levels by some members of the population. And so what you find is if you look in that book that there, if you limit yourself to certain species and in particular the smallest of those species, they think you can eat some of the fish. Now, I think in light of the epidemiological article that I cited earlier, those limits need to be rethought. And I have requested that both the Ministry of the Environment and Health Canada do so and let me know what they think, but I haven't heard back from them.
How long have you been trying to get some information or action back from those two government groups?
Well, it depends on months. In particular, when the first thing that I asked for is for the airport, and again, the airport doesn't mean just the current private sector operator, but also the previous two operators, which were the city, and for probably the bulk of the relevant time period, the federal government, Transport Canada. You know, once the magnitude of this problem became apparent, I asked at the outset that all of these groups basically come clean and go through their records and say how much of these perfluorocarbons, including both PFAS and more recently PFECHS, they have purchased, and to account for where it went. Okay, so the point with these two chemicals is they're extremely stable in the environment, and they don't disappear. And so as a result, you know, if you bought some of this stuff, you need to have some accounting for where it went. And the silence from Transport Canada in particular is deafening. You know, we need, and again, I'm not saying that anything illegal was done. I'm just saying because we've identified this problem and with every passing day, we realize it was a bigger problem because the potential for harm at lower levels of this, you know, it's time to get on top of this and figure out what happened there and clean it up. And one of the things that really irritates me is that thousands and thousands of dollars of public money have been spent by scientists at the provincial level, scientists at the federal level, and even citizen volunteers like myself, trying to figure out where this came from and when and how. And actually the science has found out a lot, but it really amazes me that all of these thousands and thousands of dollars of public research are spent on some type of Sherlock Holmes exercise trying to figure out what happened when the airport actually knows.
Yeah, it's our tax dollars being spent, right?
They're frankly being wasted because the airport, and again, the airport means all of the relevant operators, is refusing to disclose in a useful manner what happened there. And it is both a waste of public resources and research, and it's a disservice to the public because it really slows the public's understanding of the nature of the problem.
So can I ask, is it because they can't deal with it themselves, or is it too costly? What would be the reasons that they...
The fact of the matter is there is an identified major public health problem wrapped up in this, and I have called for these people for 8 months now to say what they know, and they're not doing it. Now, I think, you know, people need to ask them why.
Can we get it through Freedom of Information possibly?
I don't know, but considering the health implications of people eating the fish downstream in particular, you know, this is a big problem that's not going away. And eventually we're going to know all of this. And at the end, when we know all of this, is the answer going to be that it had to be beat out of these relative groups at great public expense and effort over 2 years, 3 years? Or is it that they knew, they recognized the problem, they admitted the problem, and they were forthcoming with the information? And we've had 8 months of non-disclosure. The question is, how long are we going to continue with this? I think it's irresponsible, frankly, to allow the public funds to be spent investigating something that we know, that there are people who know what happened, and rather than saying what happened, they're allowing for it to
slide. Yeah.
And it's both a waste of public resources, and it's an increase in health exposure to the public.
And you've been to City Hall. Has the mayor or the city said anything about – I read someplace they made an attempt to build some dikes to try and stop some of this runoff.
There is a short-term cleanup plan, which is welcome. However, I have identified some concerns with – that short-term cleanup plan, and I haven't received a response to my concerns. I do have to give the airport credit for doing the short-term cleanup plan because it's better. It is probably better than doing nothing. It's a very complicated issue. Again, my ability to communicate effectively with both the airport and the public about the potential problems is hampered by the secrecy that is involved at the airport. And so that's something, you know, that's positive. But there's a number of, again, it's a huge problem. There's a number of problems. Essentially, what was believed to be the dominant source of PFAS to the Welland River downstream is this aircraft firefighting practice pad. And the airport, over the years, after this site was largely decommissioned, and not used very much for firefighting practice. Started to use this site as a kind of a construction staging area. They built a couple of buildings on the site where they store construction equipment. And they store construction materials like pipes. And they put old disused pieces of building material and things that look like toll booths or maybe parking entrance booths, you know, they store stuff there. And amongst the materials they store there was very large volumes. I still need to calculate the amount of something called RAP fill, where RAP stands for recycled asphalt pavement. This material was dumped on the surface of the toxic contaminated Hamilton International Airport firefighting practice pad and left there for more than 2 years. And very recently, this material, the vast majority of this material, was scooped up off of the toxic contaminated Hamilton International Airport firefighting practice pad and distributed around the edges of the airport property next to neighbors, frankly. And I don't think that this was a wise thing to do. And I anticipated that they would maybe be doing this. And so back in, I believe, May, I said that, you know, this material shouldn't be moved without the potential for contamination being addressed. And that concern was ignored and they just went ahead and did it. And I don't know what the consequences are. I suspect that there was some spread of contamination, but evaluating the amount would be difficult and expensive.
Okay, well, we have a problem local to Hamilton we call Aerotropolis, and that means the expansion of that airport. That would come into play, I would think, the redistribution of the asphalt. If they put it at the edges.
What they used it for is they were building what they are calling a new perimeter road, essentially just inside the perimeter fence of the airport. I was told by the airport operator that the purpose of this road is to monitor the edges of the airport to prevent coyotes from entering the airport property and potentially being hit by an aircraft, which would be bad for everybody, in particular the coyote. And so, you know, the need for that road is, you know, the official business of the airport and the city. Whether or not the best material for this road was in fact material that had been stored on a toxic contaminated site for 2 years, I think is the question. It's one of the many things that it's just ongoing things at the airport where concerns are brought up very carefully and sent to the airport and the city and the Ministry of the Environment. The concerns get ignored and actions are taken. And I think that the reason why these, in my opinion, errors continue is because there is some odd secrecy wrapped up both at the airport and at the Ministry of the Environment involving activities at the airport. And I don't understand the reason, because it doesn't seem to be a matter of legality or not. It's just a matter of trying to be proactive in identifying potential problems and avoiding future mistakes. And we just had failure after failure after failure in regard to this mess at the airport that are mainly, I think, you know, history will show when we get done with this mess, are all basically communication errors. And I think these communication errors are basically worsened by the secrecy that continues.
Well, it's business, and if they don't have a solution to their problem, another way to solve their hydraulic loss or maybe deal with a plane fire, I don't know the details of that, but if they don't have an alternative way to do it, that would explain why they don't want anybody to know what's going on.
I do not understand the secrecy. This isn't the first time. There are a huge number of various contaminants that flow off of airport property, both down the Welland River and out other at lower levels side streams and into the city's sewage system. And by and large, these problems are never proactively identified by the airport. And we're talking about glycol and heavy metals and PFOS and PFECHS. They have to be identified by other people. The history is the first thing that happens when you identify these problems is there's a denial that it's theirs. And then finally, there's an acceptance that it's theirs, but there isn't really a forthcoming statement about their operations that would explain and frankly help mitigate the problems. It's constantly a defensive wall.
I understand, but you've painted a pretty clear picture of what's been going on for a long time. So, I mean, there's been a lot of articles in the Hamilton Spectator. They keep popping up, but nothing seems to change. I understand your frustration because you've clearly pointed out something that you see without a doubt is a problem. And you basically want people to know what's going on with the water table up there. And I'm sure the people up there know about it too. But it's Hamilton's a strange city in the fact that it has this escarpment of 1,200 feet in spots. And so the lower city doesn't really take that much concern with the upper city, which is where the airport is. And unfortunately, all those water tables are going to drain down eventually, as you said, into the Hamilton Sewer Treatment Plant. So we all need to be aware. Now, the other thing to point out here is our weather has changed. Our climate has changed. So now we get flooding. We get a lot more water dumping onto these toxic surfaces. And that's going to create an even bigger problem.
Yeah, probably. The best way to try to get a handle on the potential future problems would be if the airport would be more proactive about what it's doing there and what it put where and when, so that we can, you know, have a serious public discussion about mitigation as opposed to what seems to be the current operating mode of the airport, which is to say as little as possible, try to have other people prove what the problems are, and then find out what the minimum level of activity is to reach legal compliance.
And that's what this city has been doing for decades. That's how it operates in my vision. What can we do, Joe, besides doing a show like this and talking about it and getting that news out there? What can the public do? What do you want them to do?
Well, I think the first thing that is needs to be said not only to the people that live downstream of the airport, but to anybody who would go to this area to fish. I would think the largest identified current problem is don't, in light of more recent scientific evidence, I personally will not be eating fish from this, even though I have in the past. I will not be eating fish from this waterway until the science is clarified. I think there's adequate reason to believe that eating any concentrated source of PFAS, such as the fish in the Upper Welland River or Benbrook Reservoir, is a mistake for your health. The levels in – see – there's two main problems with this class of chemicals, and one is the fact that they don't degrade, and so they remain in the environment for a long time. The other one is biomagnification. And so the concentrations that are present in the fish are much, much greater than the concentrations that are in the water. And so I don't think that there is an established health concern based on current science with swimming in the lake. It is clear that the levels of PFAS in the lake are actually, I need to go check this, but I'm pretty sure they're certainly higher than background, and I'm pretty sure they're higher than Lake Ontario. The last time I looked at the data, see, the data keeps improving as we pry little bits of it out of them. I believe that the levels in that reservoir are higher than Lake Ontario. So, I mean, one way to look at this is I think for years people came to Benbrook to swim thinking that it was less contaminated than Lake Ontario. I think it is fair to say that with respect to PFAS in particular, that isn't true. And so if you live down by Lake Ontario and you're driving to Benbrook because you're worried about swimming in Lake Ontario, you're actually wasting your money and your fuel and resources. I honestly don't think that the current science says that even though the levels of PFAS are elevated in the lake, that they're elevated enough to cause a swimming problem.
Okay, but that's to my mind, that's a pretty scary line to look at compared to what we found out.
If you're concerned about your exposure to this chemical, there is no reason to go to Benbrook thinking that it's cleaner than Lake Ontario, because in fact the opposite is
true.
That's
the point we're making. Yeah, it's a good point. We're almost finished here. I mean, we've pretty much run out of time. What would you like to wrap up with? And I want to again say that Joe is actively involved with Environment Hamilton, which is a wonderful citizens organization, lots of volunteer work. I wish every city or town had a group like Environment Hamilton where people like Joe get involved and they find these things out on their own time. We need these sort of citizen activists, and maybe activist is a little stronger word than what could apply, but you people do deep research, you do scientific research, and you publish it as much as you can. You can also do with some more volunteers, I'm sure.
Yeah, look, you have to realize that although I'm currently a homemaker and watch two kids, and that's my job, I do have a professional background as a scientist, as a biologist. I do have published peer-reviewed articles in biology. However, I am uncomfortable with calling what I currently do for Environment Hamilton science if the science is understood as leading to publications in peer-reviewed journals, because I don't have the resources available to me or, frankly, the time to do that type of detailed work as a volunteer. As a citizen, I consider myself to have a very strong scientific background. Mm-hmm. I can understand the science that is published about this by working professional scientists, and I can explain what I think that means and raise concerns about what we should do. And in particular, in this case, I was able to identify very early on in this process a single missing piece of data that would greatly advance our understanding. I was able to basically pay for a private lab to analyze that sample, which essentially proved that the airport was the source of the PFAS contamination essentially before the scientists, either at the provincial or federal levels, did. And I was able to also, and at a time that the airport was really denying that they were the problem.
Well, that's what we need, and that's what Environment Hamilton is all about, is volunteers that are out there actively watching and taking notes and poking the various government ministers and saying, take a look at this. And the problem I keep seeing is, as you pointed out again in this show, is that the government is really slow to take action, and so we need public awareness through community radio shows like this and community links and what you can find on the social media, because you'll get more detail that way. You'll find the reports and you'll be able to read it for yourself. And we're so happy to have you here today to explain in almost basic English what this stuff is, what it does to us or to living organisms like animals, and why it's a danger. And that is invaluable to have that kind of information. Joe, I want to thank you so much for coming in today and talking about this. Is there anything that you want to finish off with?
No, thank you for having me. And I do feel that it is a matter of public education, and this radio program helps. And I would encourage the various levels of government to, rather than fighting this education, to be more proactive and actually help with releasing the relevant information so that the public can learn about it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Joel Miner gave his final report to Council Monday, December the 12th. You can hear his added frustration. He still hasn't had information or feedback from the MOE, which is the Ministry of the Environment. We couldn't get all of that discussion on. We didn't have enough time. There was a debate by City Council as who is responsible, who should pay for it, when should all of the repair work, or when should the damage stop? And if the city steps in to make the damage stop now, why should the city pay for it? It all got into a big legal circle that eventually went into a thing they call in camera, which confuses me because what it means is out of camera, out of eyeshot, where they got some legal advice.
This is, and Mr. Napper will confirm, this is an historical contamination. It's not an ongoing spill. And it dates back until to the mid-80s, which is 25 years ago. So it's been real difficult. You have to look at the ownership structure first. It was originally Department of Defense, which then became, it was later to Transport Canada, at which point in approximately 1989, I believe, in the report, we had a similar relationship that Tradeport has to now when the Regional Municipality of Hamilton-Wentworth became the operator and Transport Canada remained the ownership. In 1996, that changed to the fact that the city became the owner, and then immediately Tradeport, through a competitive bid process, became the operator. What we do know and what we have been able to conclude is that the municipality, in terms of training, was responsible during the time from 86 to 89 when the PFAS was in use in the PFAS-laden foam, that we were responsible for less than 10% of the usage in terms of our training. The remainder of that use of foam was municipalities and airports throughout Ontario, which was conducted and led by Transport Canada, as far away as Timmins, Ontario. Island Airport staff, all his training occurred during that time, and only, as I say, less than 10% was actually on account of city staff training related to the comments from the Niagara Region Conservation Authority.
Good afternoon, Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Napper.
This, in terms of the speech by Darcy, we are in regular contact with the Niagara Conservation Authority. Part of those conversations has been our plan to, or the plan of all the parties to stem the flow of any further contamination off the airport site. Our track back in May of this year identified the airport as the primary source of the PFAS contamination.
Is to deal with that issue right off the bat, because the source of this this PFAS contamination into Lake Niapenko and beyond is really from the runoff of what's on the Hamilton Airport. My understanding, and again, I'm not a chemistry or biology major, but the actual migration in the sediment is extremely slow. It would take 20 years for stuff to get off airport property. It's the runoff of the water that's PFOS laden that really causes a problem, which is why, you know, immediate measures were taken by Tradeport.
Best information that we have available at the moment is that PFOS was being was a component of firefighting foam that was in use from 1986 to 1989. So it spans the area when Transport Canada was owner and possibly operator, and also when the region was operator.
Well, it's a 30-some-odd-year problem, a 30-year problem, 26-year problem, and now suddenly becomes urgent. But I think at this point, the $40,000 that we're being asked for, and I realize it reads without prejudice, but I think it just opens up a can of worms.
We are the owner of the property. We know that there are materials getting off-site, and we're recommending assistance, not...
Canada say, oh, by the way, you contaminated the site 26 years ago, so they're unaware of it entirely.
This summer, and Transport Canada basically said that the airport is our responsibility.
Wow.
If you want to hear that report, you can go to City Hall, www.hamilton.ca, and you should be able to find the video archive of December the 12th. So if you're interested in the details, go to your own Hamilton City Hall and listen to how council debates on how the rest of us and how chemicals damage our food in our water have to wait until everybody shuffles the deck to see who's going to pay.
Redefining Radio.
Synchro Radio.